Sorry, I'm a little bit late. I had to take care of some things regarding the building. You might notice, have you been through the building yet? Nobody's taken, oh, we got to do that. Okay, yeah, maybe today or tomorrow, after the guys have gone. It's too much now. but there's, you might have seen some of, there's two circular windows. And so one of our friends does stained glass. She's a stained glass artist. And so she volunteered to do a stained glass of Chenrezig. Chenrezig's the Buddha of Compassion, that one. And so she had just sent us the diagram and some samples of the glass she's going to use. So I was taking that out. It's really beautiful. So, sorry about it being kind of a construction site that you're walking through. That's just kind of where we're at this, you know, at our growth in the Abbey at this point. We're building Chenrezig Hall because we began to have more people, and as you can see, the dining room gets very full. You know, there's just like a few of you who came for this course, and already the dining room's full. When we have 35 or 40 people here, it's really extremely difficult. So, you know, we decided to build the new building so that there's a large dining room and a large kitchen and more bedrooms and different things like that. So we have a very good architect. We worked with him for a while to design it. And then we broke ground last August, yeah. And then they were laying the bricks, these Foswell bricks, all winter out in the cold, in the snow. It was quite amazing. But we got that done, and so now we're kind of heading towards more of a finishing point, which will be very nice. Yeah, I think the whole community's ready for it not to be a work site. But we have a very nice, you know, very nice group of people who are working on it. And it reminds you, you know, because one of the big things that we talk about in Buddhist practice is the kindness of others. And although it's very easy to appreciate the kindness of our friends and our family and the people who, you know, who we're attached to, who help us in that way, we often ignore the benefit we receive from other people. And instead we have an attitude of, well, you know, who are they? Why should I care? Why don't they get out of my way? And, you know, and it's hard to really have a peaceful mind when we have that kind of judgment going on in ourselves. No, why is this person doing that? Why is this person doing that? I don't like this. I don't like that. This person's weird and that person's that. And, you know, it's like that becomes a big interference to having a happy life, let alone having a spiritual practice. So, you know, we really focus on contemplating the kindness of other living beings. And so one way we do it is by thinking, you know, of the kindness of strangers, of people who we don't even know, and all they do that creates the opportunity for us to have the life that we have. You know? And if you think about it, I mean, breakfast this morning, did we think when we ate breakfast, you know, of all the living beings behind our having breakfast? Yeah, I mean, just you have a piece of toast, let's say. Yeah. So where did the wheat, you know, where did the bread come from? Okay, well, there's the grocery store. So then there's all the people who work in the store and the people who stock the shelves and the people who order the bread and the people who constructed the store. Yeah. And then, well, where did the wheat for the bread come from? Well, then you get the farmers who planted it and reaped it, but then they use machines, and so where did those machines come from? All the people who made farming equipment. And how did they, were they able to do it? Well, because there were miners who took different metals and minerals and so forth from the earth and the factories that made the equipment, that the farming equipment, so that the farmer could use it. So, you know, we had some bread, and but the bread was wrapped in plastic, and where did that come from? Then there were other people who made the plastic and designed the plastic, and when you start like looking out at it and really contemplating it, just to have one piece of toast involves the labors of, you know, could we ever really finish counting the number of people that were involved in our having a piece of toast? And when you think about it, I mean, it's kind of like, oh my goodness, I really am dependent on other living beings. Yeah, because without all those people doing those things, no way is this piece of toast going to pop up, you know, in front of me. And then who bought the toast? I mean, who bought the bread? Because we don't go and buy groceries. Well, somebody donated the bread to us. Yeah. And so you just start looking, and there's so many people who are involved. And then if you put butter on your bread, where did the butter come from? And then how about the people, you know, who raised the cows, that gave the milk, that made the butter, and all the factories involved in that, and wrapping the butter up and shipping it, and, you know? So we start seeing that, wow, you know, we're not autonomous individuals that can take care of ourselves. We're actually very dependent on other living beings for everything we have. Yeah. And if you look at it, I mean, could any of us have eaten what we had for breakfast this morning if we were out on our own and had to grow our own food and prepare everything? No, we couldn't have, you know. So this is a whole history of people behind it. Now you might say, well, you know, okay, yeah, sure, they did their job, but they were getting paid, and they weren't thinking of benefiting me. Yeah, they were just doing their job because they wanted to get some money. That doesn't negate the fact that they're kind. Yeah, because the bottom line is, if they didn't do what they were doing, we wouldn't have had breakfast. That's the bottom line. It doesn't matter, you know, why they did it. It's the fact that we benefited from it, and that our breakfast depended on the efforts of so many living beings. Yeah, and so in that way, we really see their kindness, and we feel close to them. We feel related to them. Yeah. Are you getting what I'm saying? Yeah? And I think this is very important, because I don't know about you, but when I was growing up, it was like I just had this feeling of entitlement. You know, everything appeared. Everything I wanted, not everything I wanted, but, you know, most of the things I wanted, most of the things I needed, they just kind of appeared. Yeah, and if they didn't, I would make a fuss until my parents got it. Yeah? And I would nag, and I would pester, and I would say, Jeannie Gordon has it, how come? She was the girl across the street. Her parents got her this, how come I can't have it too? Yeah. And just, you know, I just thought things appeared, and I was the center of the universe and deserved all of this. And, you know, it wasn't really until I encountered the Dharma that I began to see, no, that so many people are working and putting forth their effort. And for whatever reason they're doing it, that's still kindness, because I couldn't exist without them doing what they're doing. Yeah. And then you might say, well, I went out to work and I earned the money. Well, who gave you the skills to earn the money, to get the money to buy your bread? Yeah? Were we born with all the skills that we have now? Were we born with the knowledge that we have now? When we were born, we didn't know anything. All we knew how to do was cry and eat and go to the bathroom. You know? I mean, we couldn't even put clothes on and take them off. We couldn't do anything, you know. The firstborn couldn't even roll over. So, you know, completely dependent on the kindness of others who took care of us. Yeah? And just seeing this and realizing, wow, you know, I've been the recipient of a tremendous amount of kindness in my life. And without which, you know, I wouldn't have the knowledge to even get a job. Or I wouldn't have the skills to get a job. I only have the knowledge and the skills because other people taught me. And if I have, you know, some special athletic ability or music ability or artistic ability, it's because somebody else taught me and encouraged me and brought that out in me. Yeah? And so, you know, to get rid of this feeling that, you know, I'm just me, and you know, everything should come to me because I'm me. and instead develop a feeling of wow, you know, how dependent I am and how kind other living beings have been. And then sometimes our mind says, well, yeah, okay, they may have been kind, but they've also been really mean to me too. You know, they did this, and they did this, and they did this, and they did this. And we bring out our whole, you know, file of all of our grievances, what people have done. And then we still have to ask ourselves, okay, those things happened, but when we compare them to the kindness that we received, is there really any comparison? Yeah, there really isn't. You know, the kindness we've received is far greater than the harms, because we're still alive. We're still alive, you know. And even we got injured, even we got sick, people came and helped us so we could recover. So there's really a tremendous amount of kindness. And the people who we expected more of, who didn't give us what we wanted or what we needed, you know, we need to consider that they were doing what they could given their situation, given the way they grew up, how they were conditioned to think, what they were capable of doing, you know, both mentally and physically. Yeah. I don't think people very often intend to harm others. Yeah, it's more out of people's own pain or people's own ignorance that harm occurs. Yeah, and people hurt other people when they themselves are happy. And so then the question comes, can we understand somebody else's unhappiness and why they did what they did? That harm was harmful, but can we forgive them for that? Can we understand it in one way or another? Because yeah. All of us have harmed people, haven't we? Yeah? We've all harmed people. So we want to be forgiven. And when we look at the actions we did that were harmful, we can understand, oh, wow, you know, I wasn't thinking very clearly. I was really being very foolish, or I was so full of anger, and my anger took over, or my greed took over, or my neediness took over. Yeah. And it was only because those kind of defiled mental states dominated my mind at that moment that I did what I did. I said those spiteful words to somebody that hurt their feelings or whatever it was. So we can look at ourselves and have some understanding for ourselves and forgive ourselves. And so then just switch that and see the other person. That's exactly their situation as well. They were unhappy. They were confused. Yeah. They were in pain. Can we understand that and offer them some compassion? So there's a lot of ways to look at, you know, not only friends, but also people we consider enemies or people, harmers, we could call them, and also strangers, and to see that, in fact, we've benefited from all of them in one way or another. Yeah? So, you know, we could walk through, coming back to the subject of being in a construction zone, we could walk through that and go, oh, God, you know, why can't these guys do this work in the middle of the night because this truck is in the way and I got, you know, I can't walk the way I want to walk and I'm afraid of getting run down and they're so noisy and, you know, why can't they do this in the middle of the night when I'm not around and they're just, you know, they won't be disturbing me. Well, anyway, in the middle of the night, if they were running the machinery, then we'd complain, why can't they do it during the day because I can't sleep. They run it at night. Yeah? But to see, you know, well, wait a minute, these people are kind in just doing what they're doing because they're building a building that we're going to be able to use. Yeah? They're benefiting us. If they weren't out there, we would all be building that building right now. And I don't know about you, but I don't know how to construct a building. Yeah? So we might all be having, you know, our lunch in, I don't know, tents of some sort. Yeah? So we have to look around and say, wow, you know, look how kind they are, devoting every day to come here and all the work and, you know, the noise and everything that they're going through to make this building. It's really quite exceptional. And I was just talking with one of the guys this morning because we're having foam insulation in the roof, and between the roof and the ceiling. And this foam is when they put it in. The guy was here yesterday. He was in the big truck that was making so much noise. So he has to completely gear up, you know, and he's covered in a hazmat suit and with a respirator, because this foam, when it comes out, it's very, very thin. So it's like spraying paint on things, but then it expands to be like 3 or 4 inches. So if when he's spraying, like even a little bit gets in his lungs and then expands, he's dead. Yeah? And so here's somebody, you know, who's kind of risking their lives to put the foam insulation in the ceiling so that in the winter we'll be warm. Yeah? And, I mean, that's a lot of kindness. And when you see them lifting some of these things and doing their thing on the roof, yeah, I mean, it's dangerous, but that's a lot of kindness. And, you know, so that we'll have a building that we'll be able to enjoy. So this meditation on kindness and on dependence, dependence on others, is something that's quite important for us. And one that, if you do this meditation regularly, your relationships with people will change. Guaranteed. Yeah, this I can put the guarantee mark on. Yeah, because this was really my own experience, you know, that when I meditated on the kindness that I've received from others, you know, it forced me to let go of a lot of the resentment and anger that I had. And it also made me open my eyes to see that I've been the recipient of so much in my life that I've basically taken for granted or had a sense of entitlement about, not really thinking who all sacrificed. And especially now, so much of many of our clothes are made in other countries. You know, when you put on your shoes or your jeans, maybe there was some, you know, 10-year-old kid who was working in the factory to make your shoes or to make your jeans. Yeah. Or maybe some 15-year-old kid who's living on the street but goes in the factory every day. or you know, you heard about in Bangladesh how the one factory that makes so many clothes for the U.S., then the whole building crumbled, and there were like how many? Well over several thousand people, was it? I forget. But many, many people died in that. And those were the people who made many of our clothes. And did we ever think of them and wish them well? Or make prayers for their good rebirth after they die? Yeah. And yet we benefited from them. So, you know, doing this meditation really changes our mind a lot. And then instead of seeing the world as kind of this, I'm not so sure about place, you know, you begin to see, oh, there's so much kindness out there. And your heart really opens to be able to give to others. So, any questions on that?
Oh, I just like to share that I was meditating on sugar.
On what?
On sugar.
Sugar.
And it started to get me to think about the history of sugar, and it struck me how so much of the slave trade was driven by the desire for this commodity, that for this little bit of pleasure. I mean, I read online that the British imported 4 million slaves from Africa to the West Indies, and by the end of the century, maybe only 400,000 were left, and they were all working on sugar plantations. So that the European middle class and lower classes who love sugar could have that. Mm. And that just, wow, really made me rethink my relationship to sugar.
Yeah.
And other such things that you think are pleasurable.
Yeah. Yeah, very much. And how much we just take sugar for granted. You know, there it is. 1 teaspoon, 2 teaspoons. Yeah. Which then brings us into the whole thing of civil rights, you know. And why are the civil rights of many people whose labor we benefit from, why are their civil rights denied? Or why are their human rights denied? Whether it be in our own country or other countries. You know, we're benefiting from these people. We're intertwined and interwoven from these people. They've been kind to us. And kind of basic human rights are something that we all agree everybody should have. So why don't we give them? Yeah. Why is there so much difficulty in extending basic human rights to everybody? Kind of amazing, isn't it, when you think about it? Yeah. And the fact, you know, we all grew up. You know, when you're educated in the American education system, we all grew up with, you know, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. You know, everybody's created equal. But then you look, and, you know, what was it, the Declaration of Independence, that's where they said all men are created equal, and they meant it literally, all men. Yeah, they left out half of the human population. Yeah. And then you add slavery in there, you left out somebody. And here were these same people who were writing that everybody's created equal, and they were slave owners. Yeah, many of them were slave owners. So, you know, we grew up with a certain vision of what our country's values are and our standards. But then, and then we look and say, oh, but, you know, other countries aren't extending human rights to people. But then we look in our own history, and my goodness, our own history is quite quite tarnished. And even now, like I was saying, how they knocked out Section 4 of the Civil Rights Act, you know, again, kind of taking away people's civil rights, making it more difficult for minorities and impoverished people to vote. So when you really feel the kindness of all these people, then it, you know, you care about them. You want to do something back. Yeah. And so on a basic level, you know, you give human human rights, or you're kind to the people around you, you know, instead of scowling and, you know, whatever. Instead of like with the road workers, you know, how the highway's backed up and you want to go somewhere because somebody's working on the road, and instead of getting really mad, like, oh, God, why are these guys fixing the roads right now? You know, again, why can't they do it at 2 o'clock in the morning when I'm not here? Because I want to drive on the road now and I don't like to be held up. But, you know, why are we held up in a traffic jam? Because those people are being kind to us. They're making the roads that we drive on. So then, you know, when we go past the road workers, we should wave and smile and say thank you. Yeah?
Yeah.
You know, and the guys who came yesterday, you know, the whole path down here was completely clogged because the people from the PUD came. And, you know, they were turning on the electric panel and doing all sorts of things. You know, say thank you, because of you we're going to have electricity to use. Yeah. Instead of, why did you park here? I can't walk. You know? So to really say thank you to the people that we benefit from. Okay? It really changes things. Very much changes things. Yeah? So a big part of our practice. So then that leads us into the whole topic of motivation too. Because considering that we've been the recipient of kindness, how, you know, with what kind of motivation do we interact with the rest of the world? Do we reciprocate with an attitude of kindness, you know, and appreciation and respect towards others? You know, and as I was just sharing with you, when I grew up, I certainly didn't. And oftentimes now, I don't either. And so here's where it comes in to be so important of, you know, why our motivation is so critical. Yeah, because it's really, you know, it's really showing how, it's telling what our motivation is corresponds in some way to how much we've been able to see the kindness of others. Yeah, and how much we're involved in just thinking about me. Yeah, and as you know, you brought up yesterday, so many of the problems that we face are because everybody's thinking of me. You know, what benefits me? What do I want? What are my opinions? What are my ideas? And so our motivation is really influences the actions that we do. Now, when we have a lot of this self-centered motivation of me, 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 then our actions usually are pretty self-centered as well. Now, sometimes we may have self-centered actions, but also we care about others enough that we don't directly harm them. It's like, okay, I'm going to pursue my interests, but at least I'm going to try not to harm anybody else while I'm doing so. Yeah. So, you know, that's not so bad. But then so often what happens is our attachment and our greed or our anger or our arrogance or our jealousy take over our mind. And then we do actions that directly harm others. And the thing is, from a viewpoint when we're talking about karma and cause and effect, when we harm others, we're actually harming ourselves. You know, because yesterday I was explaining that everything we do leaves like an energy imprint, we say a karmic imprint on our own mind stream that influences what experiences we encounter in our lives. Yeah, so all of our motivations are influencing what we do, and then what we do is influencing what we experience. Yeah, so there's some kind of link there between what's going on in our mind and what we're experiencing. Because, for example, if I have, let's say, jealousy in my mind, somebody else has something that I want. Yeah. And I don't want them to have it because I think I should have it. So it could be a possession, it could be a relationship or a person, doesn't matter. Could be some status. But I want to destroy what they have and get it for myself. And so I go out and do that. Maybe I steal, maybe I talk badly behind somebody's back. Maybe I create a lot of disharmony, and smear this guy's reputation and make him look really bad. And then I think, oh, that's good, you know, now he's down, I'm up, that's good. Yeah, now I'm happy. But then, you know, a couple of things. One, as I was saying yesterday, at the end of the day, we have to live with ourselves. So we're the ones who go home and say, oh, I just made a mess in somebody else's life. Do I really feel good about doing that? No. But then also, you know, through that jealousy and then those harsh words or, you know, cheating, stealing, whatever we did, then that's putting those kind of seeds or imprints in our own mind. And then at a later time, somebody else talks badly about us behind our back or ruins our reputation or rips off our stuff. Yeah, because we created the cause for it in terms of what we did. And what we did depends on our motivation. So that's why we usually start any activity with contemplating our motivation. Yeah? And really deliberately cultivating a good motivation. And especially when we wake up in the morning, you know, saying, okay, today is as much as possible what's important. Well, for me not to harm anybody. Yeah, wouldn't you say that's the most important thing every day? You know, whether we get everything done on our checklist, whether we, you know, make the ball game or not, whether we get the grades we want, isn't the most important thing every day not to harm others? Yeah, no matter what else happens. Yeah. We may get everything done that we want to do and have all the pleasure we want to have, but if we harm others in the process of it, is that really, you know, is that right? Okay, so we set our motivation first thing in the morning, you know, before we even get out of bed. Okay, first thing, you know, I'm not going to harm anybody today as much as possible. And I'm really going to watch what I do and what I think and what I say. You know, it doesn't mean I'm a bad person when I slip up and I harm somebody. Doesn't has nothing to do with me being a bad person, but it does mean that I'm planting the seeds of suffering in my own mind when I'm doing that. Okay, so we don't judge ourselves. I'm a good person. I'm a bad person. That's not anything. That has nothing to do with it, actually. No. And then we generate the motivation not only not to harm, but let's help as much as we can. So, you know, even on the chore rota, and you've got to vacuum or do the dishes or whatever. So do it with a motivation of, you know, oh, I get to help other people. This is my way of offering service and helping other people. And isn't this nice that I get to do this? You know, considering that people cooked my lunch and did the shopping and built the building and made my clothes. And now I get to do some small thing. Yeah, like, you know, wipe the tables or wash the dishes or vacuum, you know, that's going to contribute to everybody else having a pleasant environment. And so you cultivate that motivation to really be able to benefit. And so it is very important first thing in the morning, you know, to think about this. You know, what's my motivation today? You know, as much as possible not to harm, as much as possible to benefit. And then in the evening, kind of check up and see what we did. And say, oh, good, I'm off that table. That's good, you know? So-and-so was supposed to wash the table, but they forgot about it. And I just did it because it needed to be done. I'm glad. I didn't get all mad at that other person. That's good. Usually I would get mad at them for not doing their chore. But, you know, I didn't get mad. That's good. Yeah, and I just took it as an opportunity myself to extend some kindness. That's good. I rejoice. So it's a very nice way to work on ourselves, creating the motivation in the morning and then kind of digesting in the evening, evaluating how we did in the evening. Comments? Questions? So what I actually wanted to do today was... because people were saying that they wanted to know more about the symbols and things, was to kind of explain what you're seeing in the meditation hall so that you'll understand that. So let's have the motivation of without harming others and with the intention to help them, you know, can we then learn about, you know, may we then learn what, you know, the things in the meditation hall are. And this afternoon, you know, when you go out to offer service with an intention not to harm and to benefit, then, yeah, I'm going to go work in the forest or whatever you're doing. Okay, so now I'm going to be a tour guide. So, let's start with the Buddha, because that's where everything started with. Okay. So the historical Buddha lived about 25, 26 centuries ago in ancient India. He was born a prince, you know, had all sorts of wealth and so on, but he had questions about life, like what's the meaning of life and why do people get old and sick and die? Yeah, and so he set off to explore that. And, you know, by doing so, he attained full awakening, which means that all the defilements on the mind... So if you think about all the things you don't like about yourself, all those are gone. Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah.
That'd be the life.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be good? You know, like, all my bad moods, gone. All my anger and resentment, gone. All my greed, gone. All my selfishness, gone. Wow. Yeah. So, all that stuff gone, and all of our good qualities developed to their fullest extent. So that's what an enlightened being is. Okay? Every kind of defilement on the mind, through the practice of the Dharma, the Buddhist teachings, have been cleansed from the mind, and all the positive potentials in the mind, the capabilities and talents in the mind have all been nourished and brought to limitless fruition. So that's what enlightenment is. That's what a Buddha is. So the Buddha is sitting in a position. It's called the earth-touching mudra because when he got enlightened, people said, well, how do we know that you're for real? And he touched the earth and he said, the earth goddess will attest to it. This is how the legend goes. That's why his right hand is touching the earth. And then his left hand is in meditative position, you know, because when we meditate, our hands are like this. And then he's holding an alms bowl because all the wandering mendicants at the time of the Buddha went on alms and collected their food from the villagers. Sometimes people translate it as a begging bowl. That is incorrect. Yeah, monastics are not permitted to beg. Yeah, we are permitted to collect alms. The difference is when you're begging, you're asking people. Yeah. When you're collecting alms, you're holding your bowl, and then people give because they want to. Okay? So he's wearing the gold robe. All of us have that. We wear it for special occasions. Long earlobes show that he was once a prince, you know, because The royal caste used to wear very heavy jewelry that stretched out their earlobes, so that he had that and then renounced it. Okay, you know, this is the third eye, in the sense of having clairvoyant powers and super sensory, super knowledge powers. And then it's interesting because actually monastics have shaved heads, but the Buddha's always depicted as having hair, you know, with each hair kind of curled around, and then this crown protrusion. So this is all symbolic. At the time of the Buddha, in Indian culture, they had this thing called the 32 signs of a great person. And so the hair, the long earlobes, many of these things are part of these signs that were very common in Indian culture. Okay, so the head protrusion represents, you know, a fully awakened being, and the hair, I can't remember what it represents, but, you know, something to do with how the Buddha followed the path to be able to accumulate all the causes to enlightenment. Okay? He's usually depicted sitting on a flat disc of a sun and a moon. The moon often represents bodhicitta, the love and compassionate thought, and then the sun represents wisdom, so showing that he's mastered those. And then the lotus often represents renunciation, that he's given up kind of the craving for worldly things, you know, the mind that's completely involved in I want, I don't like, I want, I don't want, you know, in regards to worldly things. So that's the lotus. Okay? Then above the Buddha is His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who is the spiritual and political leader of all the Tibetans. He's not the leader of the Gelugpa tradition. The Ganden Tripa is of that, but he's the spiritual leader of all of the Tibetans. And then on this side, we have Maitreya Buddha, and that side, Manjushri. And Maitreya, you know, again, as the story goes, in our particular eon, there's going to be 1,000 Buddhas who come and do what we call turning the wheel of Dharma. In other words, in a historical time where the teachings are not available, they're going to be the teacher and set the wheel in motion. So Shakyamuni Buddha is the fourth of those 1,000, and then Maitreya is going to be the fifth. Okay, and from Maitreya in particular, we have a series of teachings on how to develop love and compassion and generosity, ethical conduct, fortitude, you know, all sorts of skills that we need to be able to benefit others, you know, in terms of our conventional world. So, you know, that lineage primarily came from Maitreya. And then Manjushri, oh, and our little kitty, Maitri, that's her namesake. Okay? Maitri or Maitreya means love. Okay? And the word is Jampa in Tibetan, so that's her namesake also. Okay? And then Manjushri, Tibetan name is Jampel, is the Buddha of wisdom. And so he is holding a sword, and his sword represents wisdom. In other words, the wisdom that cuts away all the wrong conceptions. So he's not fencing or anything like that. And the sword is double-edged, which symbolizes that his wisdom concerns all the conventional phenomena as well as the deeper or ultimate mode of existence. So doing away with both of those, all misconceptions regarding those two. And then, so that's his right hand, and his left hand, he's holding a lotus flower on top of which is a text. And the text is the Prajnaparamita text, or the Perfection of Wisdom text, which talks about the ultimate nature and how to realize it. Okay, so the most of the teachings that we have on the wisdom aspect of the path, they come from Manjushri, descended that way. Okay, the little ball kind of like things at the bottom there, you'll see those on a lot of the tankas. Those are jewels, so they're meant to be offerings to whatever deity it is. And all these deities, you know, whether it's Chenrezig or Medicine Buddha or, you know, Maitreya, Manjushri, they're all seen to be manifestations of the mind that is completely free of all defilements and has actualized all good qualities. So these different Buddhas are not different people, so to speak. They're different manifestations. Okay, then we have on the altar, this is Vajrasattva, and so he's holding a vajra, which represents bliss, and then a bell, which represents wisdom. And his speciality as one of the Buddhas is to help with purification. The idea being that we've all done things that we regret, that we know harmed ourselves and harmed others. We want to purify those things so we don't experience the result. So Vajrasattva is very good to help us in terms of purifying. Okay? This is Tara over here with all the jewels, and she's one of the female manifestations of the Buddha. She's usually depicted in bright green, or more of an emerald green color. And her speciality is quick wisdom and also the Buddha's enlightened activities. Yeah, so she's very good for clearing obstacles and making things successful. This is a stupa there. That particular one is a replica of the stupa at Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha meditated, where he attained full awakening. Yeah, and the stupas, you know, come from ancient Indian culture. When a great living being died or when some great occurrence occurred, they would often build some kind of mound and shape it to mark the place. So, and then as time went on, those became more decorative and developed certain, you know, became like buildings almost. But, you know, the stupas you'll find all over India. You know, and they represent the Buddha's mind, actually. Then the small statues behind that are on the green shelf, there's 16 of the small statues where they all, if you look, they're all shaved and they all look rather thin. And then there's one there with hair who's a little bit plumper. So, It said that there were 16 arhats. An arhat is a liberated being who has eliminated not all defilements, but a big chunk of their defilements, enough to get them out of the cycle of rebirth. And they're all monastics. And they're shown as being rather thin because they're living on alms. Okay? And so there's 16, and those 16, it said, they lived at the time of the Buddha, but they never really died. They exist, some of them went into mountains, and they're living inside mountains and teaching people or went to other places, but they're all still alive, as the story goes. And then the one on the end there is the Bodhisattva who is their attendant. Okay. Because as monastics, there's many things that we aren't permitted to do, so then it's very helpful to have an attendant who can help you with many of those things. Okay, then on this side, this is Jesongkhapa. He lived in late 14th, early 15th century in Tibet, and he's the founder of our particular Tibetan Buddhist tradition. He was a great scholar and an incredible practitioner. And you can see that, you know, both of his hands are holding lotuses. On one is the sword, on the other is the Prajnaparamita text, because it said that he was actually a manifestation of Manjushri, who is also holding the sword and the Prajnaparamita text. This one, the white one, is Amitabha. So we'll be teaching you some chanting involving Amitabha, and that is the what in the Chinese tradition what Amitabha looks like, and we have a lot of Chinese connection here, so we do that Amitabha practice. And then the statue is of Chenrezig. That's thousand-armed Chenrezig, 11-headed, thousand-armed. This tanka here is also of Chenrezig. You can see the thousand arms, you know, the white, all of those thousand arms around. Here, clearly, you know, they couldn't put all thousand on the statue. Yeah. But again, there's so much symbolism. You know, Chenrezig, that's why we're called Chenrezig Hall, is the Buddha of compassion. So, you know, with 11 heads and all those eyes, he's looking out at the welfare of all the sentient beings. And with 1,000 arms, he's reaching out to benefit all of them. And actually, in all of his arms, there's in the palm of each hand, there's an eye also looking out and caring about sentient beings. Yeah. So you can see there's something even, you know, by the way that Chenrezig's standing, you know, the first two hands are like this. This is, you know, a mudra of respect or greeting, but primarily respect. And then all these other arms reaching out. Yeah. So when you reach your arms out, when you go like this, you get a certain kind of feeling, don't you? It's very different than sitting like this. Yeah, so Chenrezig's like this, like, welcome everybody. I'm completely open. I'm vulnerable. I'm ready to love you. I'm not afraid of anything. Yeah, and I'm looking out with care. Looking out, arms open, open here. Yeah? How do we often sit? You know, what does body language tell us? What's going on in us when we're sitting like this?
You're defensive or you don't want to talk.
Yeah. Yeah, we're explaining something through the way our body is. Yeah. So all these different Buddhas around, they're explaining something through how their body is. Yeah.
Why does Chenrezig have the blue ruffle face close to the top?
At the very top. Because compassion sometimes can on the surface look wrathful. In other words, compassion wishes for people to be free of suffering and wants to eliminate that suffering. So often compassion is, we extend compassion in terms of kindness, helping and being kind and encouraging, but sometimes compassion has to be manifest in a very wrathful way, you know? Like when somebody's just really messing up, yeah, and the only way to get through to them and say, look, you're making a mess of your life, or you're creating a ton of negative karma that's going to harm you, is to appear in a very wrathful way. Yeah? So that's why there's the wrathful head. And that's why there are wrath, you know, if you look on this tanka too in the bottom, there's many, you know, different wrathful Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. But that's what they represent. It's kind of the, you know, sometimes do you ever get to the point in your life where you just say, I got to cut this out. You know, just cut it out. You know, I'm being a jerk. Cut it out. Yeah? So that to me is what the wrathful deities, that's the same energy. It's like, just cut it out, you know? It's like, this is not helping you, it's not helping anybody else. Cut it out. Yeah? And at that point, I need that kind of energy that says, cut it out. I don't need, oh, gee, I'm sorry that you're suffering and this is too bad, and some kind of, you know, kind manifestation of compassion. I need a fierce manifestation of compassion. Okay. Yeah, so that's Chenrezig, Buddha of Compassion. That's Medicine Buddha over there, deep blue color. Again, you can see the long earlobes, the, you know, the crown protrusion and all. And in his begging, in his alms bowl, he's holding nectar, you know, nectar that brings health and immortality. And then his right hand is extended with the palm up, which is the gesture of giving. Yeah.
What do the different colors represent of the Buddhas?
Yeah, they resonate within you in a different way. The white, like in the case of Vajrasattva, Vajrasattva's white, so there the white usually would represent purity. You know, Medicine Buddha's dark blue, I'm not sure how dark blue became the color. If it has to do...
Just 'cause?
Yeah. Well, no, I'm sure there's a reason. It may have to do with the color of one of the kinds of internal energies. You know, the different internal energies have different colors, and so it may have to do with that. He's also wearing the monk's robes. And in his right hand, you know, it's in the gesture of giving, but it's also holding the stem of an aurora plant. And an aurora is a kind of plant in India that's the basis of most of the medicine. I think it's myrobalm in English.
And why does he have a robe and this white scarf or whatever?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, why it's white underneath? I mean, robe, because he's, you know, a monastic. Why the white? I don't know. Because usually monastics don't wear white.
Yeah? I just wanted to be different. Why do monastics shave their heads?
Okay, why do we shave our heads? Well, there's a few reasons. One is that our hair is often a sign... We care a lot about how we look, and that manifests through how we take care of our hair. Yeah? Because people spend a lot of time on their hair. You know, how does my hair look? If you have straight hair, you want it to be curly. If you have curly hair, you want it to be straight. If it's dark, you want it to be light. If it's light, you want it to be dark. If you don't have any hair, you want to get some. You know, if people care so much about their physical appearance, and it comes out very often in terms of their hair, and, you know, caring about their hair, and dyeing it, and cutting it, and shaping it, and everything like that. So what we're doing in shaving our head is we're saying, I don't care how I look externally. I care more about how I am internally. And I think I may have mentioned before, you know, it's like if people are going to like me, it's not because I'm attractive physically. It's going to have to be because of some internal qualities that are attractive.
So does a monastic have to shave their head?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we take monastic vows, we have to keep our hair short.
And how was
it
the Buddha's time? Was there plants who had the hair that hair symbolizes maybe something like prestige, or because maybe the hair was had another meaning at that time?
Yeah, well, also, I mean, in all times, how you do your hair has something to do with how you present yourself as a person. Yeah. So having a knot, you know, and if you tied your hair up in a knot in Buddhist time, that was some kind of prestige. Now, you know, you see the businessman haircut. Yeah. Or you see, you know, the different haircuts how people are kind of conveying something about, you know, the image they want to give, how they want to be perceived. So shaving the hair is also indicative of saying, I want to cut off my ignorance, anger, and attachment. Yeah, get rid of it. If it were only that easy, wow, wouldn't that be nice?
You'd save a lot of time.
I think that's why we have to keep cutting our hair, yeah. You know, because we haven't gotten rid of all the ignorance, anger, and attachment yet. Keeps growing back. Yeah. back there we have White Tara. She's another of the female manifestations of the Buddha, and her speciality is long life. Yeah, so she, again, her hand is extended in the gesture of giving. Her right hand and her left hand is in a gesture like this called the gesture of the three jewels. So the thumb and the ring finger represent wisdom and compassion unified, and then the three fingers that are up represent the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And then on her the lotus that she's holding in her left hand, there is a bud, a blossom lotus, and then a very open lotus. So it represents the Buddhas of the future, present, and past. Yeah. Back there, that's the tanka of the 35 Buddhas. You've been doing the bowing to the 35 Buddhas every morning. So that's them. The last row, the last row is offering goddesses, and the row before that are the medicine Buddhas. Yeah, so medicine Buddha, that's the primary medicine Buddha, but he also has an entourage. So those are them. Above the window, those are the 17, there should be 17 of them there. It looks like 16, but there should be 17.
There is 18.
There's 18.
Yeah.
Oh,
they're in the picture.
Oh, that's because the Buddha's in the center. Yeah, the Buddha's in the center, and then the 17. Uh-huh. So those are 17 of the great Indian sages. Yeah, because after the Buddha passed away, then the tradition was carried on by these Indian sages. Who wrote texts and who actually practiced, and it's their writings that we really depend on, you know, as well as the Buddha's writings that we depend on. And then this tanka is called the Field of Merit, and the central figure in the middle is Jaisongkhapa, on, you know, who we met here, who's this, the founder of our lineage, and then on his right, so on the left as we look at it, is Maitreya Buddha, surrounded by all the lineage of people who passed down the teachings about love and compassion and bodhicitta. On Tsongkhapa's left, in other words on the right as we look at it, is Manjushri, the Buddha Manjushri, surrounded by all the Indian and Tibetan sages who passed down those teachings. And then behind are another lineage of the profound practice. And then in the front we have rings of different deities, and then a ring of the Buddhas, of Pratyeka Buddhas, of Arhats, liberated beings, of Dakas and Dakinis and Dharma protectors. And so, in other words, all of the beings who have realized the nature of reality, some of whom are fully awakened Buddhas, some are not fully awakened, but they're definitely out of cyclic existence. And so that's all of them together. And so we do certain practices where we imagine all of them and then make offerings and so on. Yeah, it's quite a beautiful practice that we do. So that's... Oh, and then the tanka in the very back, above the table there, that's called the Wheel of Life. And, maybe let's go stand there and I'll point it out to you, and then we can...
And then
oh, yeah, yeah. Well, maybe...
So they usually put this on the door of all of the Tibetan temples. If you ever go to India, you'll see. And this is the wheel depicting the different realms of existence. So you have the human realms, you have the god realms, you have the animal realm, the hell realm, the hungry ghost realm. And then this is called the Lord of Death, which is an anthropomorphized, your anthropomorphized. anthropomorphized death, and shown that all of us living beings are caught in the cycle of being reborn, you know, of birth and death, birth, aging, sickness, and death. And so it's put on the outside of the temples to remind us of our situation, so that we get a lot of energy to practice because we want to be free of the cycle of birth and death. So that's that particular tanka. In here? These? Okay, so those represent one teaching that's called the 12 links. And the 12 links is a teaching that describes how we keep taking birth. What are the factors that propel our mind to take birth in one body after another body? And then up here you can see there's the Buddha, okay, pointing to the moon. The moon there represents nirvana. Nirvana is the state of peace, the state of liberation and freedom. So the Buddha is showing us the way to nirvana, that is free of all of that. The inner circle, this one has a chicken, a snake, and a pig. Okay? The pig represents ignorance, the chicken, attachment, and the snake, anger. So there we have this ignorance, anger, and attachment, the three poisonous minds, which I'll talk some more about later. And then here we have some beings going to lower rebirths because of the harmful deeds that come. Some beings going up to, from the lower realms to the upper realms. So within this whole thing of people going up and down and getting born in these different realms, none of it is punishment, okay? This whole Christian idea of punishment for sin is totally absent in Buddhism. It's simply cause and effect. And what kind of things, seeds you plant in your mind, you get those kind of effects. When we look at the front of the room, okay, then we have the texts on either side. So those texts are called the Kangyur. Those are the words of the Buddha. And these are the Tengyur. This is the all the scriptures written by those great Indian pandits or sages, 17 of whom are up there. And we can take out one of the scriptures. You can see a little bit how the Tibetans do things. In old Tibet, they didn't have printing presses, so they carved the scriptures on wood blocks and then made wood block prints of everything. And all the texts are unbound. So if you drop your text and the wind blows, okay. We have labels in all of the texts so that we, because they're arranged in a certain order. Okay. So all the texts are like this. This is like the front cover, and then one is the back cover. And then, like I said, they're all unbound. But you can come up and I can show you a little bit. When Tibetans write, they separate syllables by dots. So they don't separate words. You know how we write a word and then there's a space before the next word? They don't do that. They just separate syllables by dots. So that's why it just goes on and on like that. There's this kind of mark like that at the end. We put a period, they'll put something like that. But that sign, you know how we have definite, you know, subject, verb, object, and you know how you diagram sentences and all that stuff. There, some of their sentences, if you try and translate, becomes a paragraph. It's like, having done this, then having done this, and having done this with the influence of that, then this happens, which will bring this, which is related to that, which happens over here. And it can be a real chore to translate it, because the Tibetan grammar is very different from our grammar. Okay, so you can, and the alphabet, you can
can see is quite different. They have a lot of silent letters, so it's very difficult when people speak to know how something's spelled. And many Tibetans themselves don't know how to spell very well. Yeah. So the whole text, you read this way. And so in the monasteries a lot, they memorize many of these texts. The idea being if you have the text memorized, then you can just refer to it at will, you know, when you need. Yeah, it's good. You don't have to turn on your computer and look up a citation. You have it in your mind already. Yeah. So as little kids, they do a lot of memorization. And you'll hear them chanting their memorization at the monasteries over and over again.
How many are there?
Huh?
How many of the texts are
there? Of these texts? Of the Kangyur, there's 100, maybe 108, something like that. And the Tengyur, there should be about 300, I think. Although that doesn't look like 300. But maybe they're just in maybe it's not 300 volumes, maybe some of the texts are, I don't know. Anyway, something like that. Okay. And so the traditional way for the Tibetans is to wrap the text. So it's wrapped out of respect, you know, to keep the text clean and to respect it. And we show respect to the text, not just to the material, but because the texts contain the path to liberation. And of course the path to liberation is something we want to actualize in our own mind, something that we respect a lot.
And the water bowls?
I think we need to take a break.
Yeah.
So we'll do the water bowls and the other things tomorrow. Okay, so let's take a break and then come back at 10:35. Okay?